Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Last year in season one, we looked at the fortunes of the Beatles across all the Christmases of the 1960s when they were a unit living and working out of each other's pockets. And today, we're going to take a different trek. We're going to look at how they evolved through their Christmases in the 1970s. It tells a tale very different to the one in the 1960s where they went from finding themselves in Hamburg to losing each other by the end of the decade. And it's the last decade when all four of them were fully active and had stuff to do, really, didn't they?
Yep, I think so. Before they all turned 30.
Well, exactly. And it tells another interesting story when you kind of break it down and look at it year on year, just to see exactly how they all evolve and spin off into different directions and kind of form the versions of John, Paul, Ringo and George that we know of today. So we're going to look at from 1970 to 1979, and this is going to be a two-parter. So we're going to look at the top of the decade, as DJs say. And a reminder that when we get to Christmas 1970, on Christmas Day 1970, just to make everybody feel bad about themselves, John Lennon is only 30, Ringo Starr is only 30, Paul McCartney is 28, and on Christmas Day 1970, George Harrison is 27 years old.
Always younger than Paul.
Always younger than Paul. Had you, I don't know, do you ever play the mortality game where you put yourself up against what was so-and-so doing by the time they were my age? It's a dangerous thing to think about.
Well, when you get to my age, it's a very dangerous thing to think about. I used to do that all the time, but not anymore.
Yeah, I used to always think Neil Tennant, he wasn't famous till he was in his mid-30s, but then that goes sailing by. Anyway, so let's rewind the clock and go back all these Christmases ago, back to Christmas 1970. And we're going to kind of look at this each year as the Beatles overall, and then we'll pick apart what each individual Beatle was doing. And Christmas 1970 is the last Christmas when all four Beatles are in the UK at the same time. And in terms of what the band collectively were doing, obviously 1970 was the year when it all fell apart. And April 1970, as we've said earlier on in this season, is when McCartney came out and the headlines tipped over into the Beatles have split. So by the time you get to Christmas 1970, there are no Beatles and there isn't any defined course for what a band should do once they split up. So because it's the first Christmas without a Beatles Christmas record, we get the Christmas Record fan club compilation.
That's it. From then to you. See what they did there?
I see what they did there.
So they combine all of the previous flexi discs. Now, these flexi discs had only ever been issued in the UK. They'd not been issued in the US, but there is a 12-inch vinyl LP issued in America as well as in the UK. So this is the first time that the American market is getting these Christmas discs.
And as we said last year, even in 1969, when everything was falling apart for Christmas 1969, there was a Beatles Flexi Club fan club disc. And this kind of compilation album of the fan club discs is something that people have sort of expected to get an official release over the years, and it's never really happened. When they made it back at the time, they didn't have the master tapes. Sure they didn't.
Yes, this is the fun fact. They couldn't find the original master tapes, so they had to go to Freda Kelly, who was the official fan club secretary at the time, and ask her could she lend them her flexi discs from across the years, and they used those to compile the LP.
Yeah, it's amazing how people still weren't cataloguing all this kind of stuff. And the Christmas fan club album was the last of the official Christmas releases,
and very collectible.
Yeah, and it's I do think the way they put out the box set, the single box set a few years back, is possibly the best way to present some of this kind of stuff. I think if you put it on an album these days, people will think it's an album full of Christmas songs, and it's just not, obviously.
I think so. But the original, if you can find the original, what I would say, word of caution, it has been extremely heavily bootlegged.
Yes, yes.
And it can be very difficult to tell an original from the bootleg copy.
We need Parlogram Auctions to tell us what's going on.
Yes, to get in.
To give us a big spiel on that.
But again, if anyone has an original American or UK version that they would like to donate to the Nothing is Real Museum, We give it a good home.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I will give it a good home.
Yes. The other thing that happens is on TV that Christmas 1970, A Hard Day's Night gets its UK television premiere. And it's, you know, I know it's a bit of an obvious thing to say, but my God, what a change in 6 years, yeah. You know, to sit in 1970 and turn on the telly and see this movie from 1964. It must have been like, I can't imagine sitting down this Christmas in 2020 and looking at something from 2014 and thinking I'm really going to be able to notice anything specifically different.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's probably the fact that you're watching this black and white mop top movie at a time when, you know, they all have beards, they all have long hair, John and Yoko have appeared naked on the cover of an album, you know, the band have split up, it's ridiculous the sort of changes they've gone through in that period.
So for the four Beatles then, John in December 1970, he has, you know, put out the Plastic Ono Band album a few weeks earlier, and John and Yoko in December 1970, they're over in New York. They do fly back to London on Christmas Eve and spend their last Christmas in the UK. But fly is a good link.
I see what you did there.
A good link to what they were doing in New York, because they were making their, you know, fantastically interesting, experimental films.
That really, if you want to do a contrast between A Hard Day's Night and the first of those films, Up Your Legs Forever.
And tell us about Up Your Legs Forever.
Up Your Legs Forever. It is available on YouTube.
It is.
It is. I think it runs for an hour and 10 minutes, something like that.
And what's the plot, Stephen?
The plot.
Is missing. Well,
I've actually got the entire script.
Oh, okay.
The shooting script. So the entire script reads, the camera work of the film should constantly go up, 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 non-stop. Collect 367 pairs of legs and just go up the legs from toes to the end of thighs, pair after pair, and go on up until you run through the whole 367. So yes. Essentially, this is a bit like Yoko's Bottoms film.
Yeah, except you don't see anybody's bottom except...
Except at the very end, you see John and Yoko's bottom, which is, you know, always a treat. But the other 367, you get to see their knees, essentially.
Yeah, it's just like a slow pan. You don't get to see any to evoke Kenny Everett naughty bits.
No, you don't get to see anything. But this is just another one of their slightly odd films. I think the background to this is they had agreed to put films into a sort of artsy film competition or show them, and then of course having agreed to do that they had to come up with a film.
Yeah,
so this does date all the way back to Yoko's book Grapefruit. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of that. She has these were a series of instructional poems, and there's a poem Summer 1963 called Fly Piece, P-I-E-C-E, and the poem is Fly.
Fantastic. Well read. That's great.
Well read.
Because that's the other film they make, is the fly film.
Yes. Yes.
And this is what? They drugged some flies and put them on a woman's body. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, we've all been there. No, we haven't. We haven't. In case anyone's listening.
No, we haven't, Your Honor.
Anyone, you know, Your Honor, any legal. Yes. The idea here is that they had a woman lying naked. And there were close-ups of a fly wandering around her body, so that you become focused on the fly itself, and the woman's body just becomes like a landscape, it says here. But yes, the flies, hard to get flies in New York in December. That was the first thing.
Yeah.
They had to go to restaurant kitchens, which is not a particularly good
advertisement.
And then they had to actually, yes, gas them. So that they kind of staggered around instead of just flying off.
Well, if that doesn't put you in the Christmas mood, I don't know what will. It's also that month when they're kind of talking to, you know, the Jan Wenner interview has come out in Rolling Stone. So that's what John is getting the headlines for. You know, all in all, you could argue that John's had a pretty good 1970. He staked his claim for it. He's carved out his own niche. He kind of has a sense of self, and it seems like he knows what he's up to.
Yes, he does. I mean, that the Wenner interview has sort of gone on to be the stuff of legend, and there's 3.5 hours of audio for that. And I noticed the entire thing is up on YouTube.
Yeah, if you want to go and look at it. So,
Some of that interview, I think, is worth hearing rather than reading, because you do get a better sense of
his
context
his
and
his
anger, yeah, and his sort of frustration. Yeah.
So let's go maybe to Ringo next, because Ringo, for Christmas 1970, he was a new dad. His daughter Lee had been born in November. And yeah, I think the most important thing to happen to any ex-Beatle in the 1970s was when at Christmas 1970, he gave his wife that beautiful gift that we all love to give our loved ones, which was, let me check my notes here, Perspex filled with mercury.
Yes, it's the traditional Christmas gift.
It is. I think, I don't know, is it a fifth Christmas? Who knows when it's mercury-filled like Perspex. Yeah. But the thing we've talked about before in this show is Ringo's furniture design emporium and expertise, and yes, which was Ringo or Robin, run with Robin Cruikshank. And so this is early Ringo and Robin fair that he gets. He thinks, Ringo thinks these things are hugely entertaining. Perspex, yes, discs full of mercury. I mean, why not have a chewable carcinogen near a child? It seems like a perfect idea.
I was going to say, we have a baby in the house, let's get some mercury.
And but Ringo or Robin, I mean, what is interesting when you look at some of the research for this is that Ringo or Robin actually had more legs than we think. We've kind of joked about it before, but it was an entity that in its first, yes, form went on for like a decade and a half.
It did. I mean, it only sort of they ceased working together, or that organization ceased in 1986, and it began in 1968. So in 1968, Robin Cruikshank's design company began working for Apple, first of all. And then in 1969, when Ringo moved house, he got Robin to come and help him do some of the designs. And one of the first things was a stainless steel fireplace. I'm sure Ringo had somebody to clean the stainless steel fireplace.
Good Lord, how hot would that get?
Well, again, small children in the house. This is kind of health and safety out the window.
Mm, different time. And he's an interesting guy, Robin Cruikshank. He's, he had credentials. He wasn't like a Magic Alex type figure.
No. He's a British designer. He's, he's still going.
Well, this is the amazing thing that you pointed out to me, is that listeners can go and visit ROR.int.com, roarint.com, to, yeah, see the modern day Ringo or Robin website, because Ringo essentially gave him the ROR trademark, and it still trades.
It's still going. And it says there he's designed interiors for palaces in Abu Dhabi, luxury developments in the UK and Miami. So it's a long way from sort of these designs that they were doing in the 60s. The famous one that they talk about is they were out for a walk, and they walked past a sort of a motor accessory shop that had a Rolls Royce radiator sort of in the window, presumably. And they thought, well, if we got two of those, we could put some stainless steel in between and make a table. And that was one of their first designs. And these, some of them are extremely innovative, and some of them are just etchings on mirrors and things like that. And you can buy, they're available. They turn up on eBay. If you have £400 or £500, you can buy a Ringo or Robin original mirror.
And they did, I saw recently a picture of their showroom. They had a shop. There was a Ringo or Robin, yeah, shop on the high street that you could go and visit in the mid-70s. And as you say, yeah, they kept, they had showrooms in the 70s that were in Francis Wharf near the Tate Gallery. They moved to Rathbone Place in the West End. And then they moved into various offices as they went into the 80s, and then they sort of ceased trading as a duo. But the trademark, as we said, still lives on today. Go to roarint.com to see what Robin Cruikshank is up to these days.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned, I think, on a previous episode, the mirror they made for Harry Nilsson.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. With the noose on it.
They etched a noose into it so that when he was shaving in the mirror, his head was in a noose. And even Harry wasn't prepared to put up with that. They had to change.
So Ringo's having an interesting Christmas with Perspex filled or mercury filled Perspex or Perspex filled mercury.
Perspex filled mercury would be a very
good. I think I've been on the Christmas
twist.
Sherry already. and George, as we've said already in our All Things Must Pass episodes, he's kind of the king of Christmas. He's number one in the singles and the albums, and he's just king of the world. He's reinvented
the king
himself.
Of the world.
He's got his,
yep,
beard and his lovely hair. It's all, he's fantastic.
Everything's coming up Hare Krishna.
Everything's coming up Hare Krishna. So, Paul, is having maybe the slightly more stressful Christmas. He spent the end of 1970 in October, November. He's off in New York putting together the start of Ram, and then he comes back to Scotland to spend another end of year,
another chilly Christmas.
Another sort of end of year sort of abstinence or punishment up in the wilds of Scotland. But yeah, is he? I don't know. He's getting his briefs ready, would you say?
Possibly. He knows what's coming. I mean, clearly, in the run up to the end of the year, there's been a lot of sort of legal machinations, and so he knows. He's been told by the Eastmans the only way to get yourself out of this situation. And Paul is always quite clear that he just wants to get out. He just wants to be able to walk away.
Yeah.
And the Eastmans have had to sit him down and explain to him the only way you can do this is to sue the other three members of the partnership. Mm. To extricate yourself from this. So he's sort of forced into this position, and he effectively has to sue John, George, Ringo and AppleCore.
And the history books always talk about that it happens on December 31st that he sues them in court, but there's stuff that goes on preliminarily a few weeks earlier in mid-November, doesn't he? So would they have had any kind of inkling that he would have known this, or how does that work?
Well, you can. What happens is, and I'm not providing independent legal advice to
yes,
any.
Yes,
on
we're
any
just
specific
chatting
thing.
As friends. I understand.
We're just
yes.
chatting as friends. If you issue a writ, you basically you take that to the court. They stamp it, and then you have a set period of time within which you have to serve it on the other party. So my understanding is that the writ actually issued from the court office and then was served on the 31st.
But it was issued a few weeks earlier in November.
Yes.
But
yes.
I guess John, George and Ringo and Apple wouldn't have known until they get a subpoena or a notice or
oh no, they actually get served with a copy of the writ itself. So
okay. So they would have known before Christmas that this was coming.
They would have known before Christmas that it was coming. And
but the general public don't know until it lands in the courts.
No, and I think it's as you know from my professional eye, I think it's a very nice touch to serve it on New Year's Eve. I admire the sort of chutzpah of serving it on New Year's Eve.
But yeah, well, I guess everyone's going to be at home, and they can skulk around and figure out what's going on. I mean, I'm not a numerology person, but the Beatles always sort of signified the 60s, and there's something poetic that they did their last session on the 2nd and 3rd of January 1970, and then they ceased to exist on the 31st of December 1970. It fits and it makes sense, but
it does. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a certain sort of symmetry to that.
Yeah. So that lawsuit is coming, and Paul, as you say, he just says this thing repeatedly, and we'll come back to this later, that he just wants to sign a piece of paper and he just wants to be over and done with and he just wants to get his bit done. And there's this kind of revisionism, classic Paul, where he has like an interview version of it, which you see in many years from now, where he says, I didn't want to do it and I had to do it. Can you imagine how hard it was to sue the Beatles? I knew I was going to be the bad guy and it was awful. And it does have ramifications because he's seen as the guy who jumped ship in April and now he's seen as the guy who's suing them. It does put him... make him appear that way.
It does. And I think what we always say about Paul, what everyone always says about Paul, is he's the great master of PR.
Yes.
And this is a disaster from a PR point of view. Mm. So it may well have been the only way to deal with this, but it's a PR disaster. And once again, when this happens, he's in Scotland.
Mm.
So he's taken himself off. We talked in the McCartney episode about him sort of absenting himself from Apple in the latter stages of 69 and allowing sort of business decisions effectively had to go on, be taken without him. And it's the same thing here. He's the proceedings have been issued and he's nowhere to be seen. And he's not in control of the PR narrative, I suppose.
I do like the details in the suit that says it's filed against John Ono Lennon of Ascot, Berkshire, George Harrison of Henley-on-Thames, Berkshire, Richard Starkey of Highgate, London, and Applecore of Savile Road. It's a long way from Liverpool 8, all of that, isn't it? It is.
And you mentioned that interview with him in Many Years From Now, and he says, "These truest friends of mine were now my firmest enemies overnight. I'd grown up in this group. This was my school, my family, my life."
There you go.
I'll see you all in court.
Yeah. And he does that secondary thing, which he also says in interviews, which was, you know, because I did this thing, we now don't have Alan Klein's name on Beatle records. And that's a dig at the Stones, basically, you know.
I think so. I mean, he says in that interview, we did rescue the Beatle millions. We, that's himself and the Eastmans. And he said, I had to do it. It was that or letting Klein have the whole thing, all the fortune we'd worked for all our lives since we were children. And you think, well, Alan Klein was getting 20% of any increase in revenue. So it's not all of the fortune.
No. But anyway, we can go into Alan Klein in more depth some other day. So that's Christmas 1970. A lot going on. And the last one, as I said, when all four of them are in the UK. So then we go to Christmas 1971. And in terms of just general group activity, you know, A Hard Day's Night is on BBC One again, because the BBC are getting into this vibe that there's usually a Christmas Beatles movie on at Christmas time. But we might start by focusing in on John, because at this point, John is essentially based in New York. He has gone to New York at the end of summer 1971, and he never returns to the UK again.
No.
And he has put out Imagine. And the first thing he records post Imagine is the song everybody knows and loves, which is Happy Christmas, War Is Over.
Yep.
And it is the first song that is exclusively recorded by John in New York, which I think is interesting. And I think it's an interesting border song between everything before it and everything after it.
It is. I mean, I think it's, if you look from Imagine to the follow-up album, which is sometime in New York City, I mean, they are absolutely poles apart.
Yeah.
And this song, in terms of its style, its production, the musicians, everything about it sort of sits very neatly in between the two. It's a sort of transition from one to the other.
So the song Happy Christmas, War Is Over is, it comes together in actually October. And as it falls, you know, just in terms of when it's released, it doesn't actually get released in the UK until 72, but it gets released in the US in 71.
Yeah.
But it is of 71. And as I said, it's the first thing he does after Imagine comes out. So it seems to come together quite quickly, doesn't it?
It does. And we have a good sort of eyewitness account. We talked before about the journalist Ray Connolly and his part in the Beatles story. He's a journalist at the London Evening Standard, but he had been invited by John and Yoko to journey to New York, essentially to come and visit them at their hotel, which is the St. Regis Hotel.
And that's where they're living. We're not into any of the Dakota or any of that stuff yet. They start their time in New York living in this hotel.
That's it. They have a suite at the St. Regis Hotel. And so Ray Connolly is sort of hanging out there, and he gives a very good snapshot. He says it's like the headquarters of a counterculture movement. Abbie Hoffman's hanging out, Jerry Rubin. He refers to them as sort of latching on to John, and John being quite naive. But clearly, John and Yoko are there and holding court. But he then records the fact that John starts recording demo versions of what will become Happy Christmas, War Is Over. And one of the things he says, it says, John quickly turned the melody of the folk song Stewball into the festive song Happy Christmas, War Is Over while sitting with his guitar on a sofa in the St. Regis suite. A few weeks later, he and Yoko would record it a few blocks away. So he is very clear that this is John adapting a folk song, and I think this is something we touched on before.
Well, I never, I only heard the song Stewball for the first time about 4 years ago, and the first time I heard it, I was like, oh. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people listening to this today who mightn't know the song Stewball. So don't pause the podcast, go and listen afterwards. But you, it is an old folk song. Peter, Paul and Mary had a hit about 63 with it. Mm. The Hollies had it in their set, their kind of post
Graham Nash.
Yeah, post Graham Nash Hollies, when they were kind of heading into their kind of more cabaret type years. They were on BBC. Yeah. There's footage of them on the BBC in 68, 69 performing it. And yeah, it's a folk song about a racehorse, and it is essentially the melody of Happy Christmas, War is Over. And when you hear it, you're like, why is this not more well appropriated?
Well, yes, I mean, you sort of think about, My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine. I mean, it's at least as obvious as that. The version that I knew first was by Joan Baez, but it's the Peter, Paul and Mary version. The melody, the rhythm, the chord changes, everything. It's a direct lift. It's a direct lift.
Now, having said that, I'm a huge fan of Happy Christmas, War is Over, and I think it's a fantastic piece. Well, it's blunted by familiarity, I guess.
I suppose so.
And it's interesting that at either end of the 70s, we get a Christmas song from Lennon and McCartney, one from Lennon and one from McCartney. And obviously, it'll be in part two when we talk about the better song. But
for me, it's the lyric.
Okay, what's with the lyric?
The lyric is another year over, a new one just begun. And I thought, no, it's Happy Christmas. That makes no sense.
Yeah. John. Objection. Overruled. They've both written, Lennon and McCartney, these kind of Christmas standards that are still trotted out after all these years. And it's interesting to see that they are so fundamentally different as songs.
Are you saying that George hasn't written a Christmas standard?
Well, I haven't scuttled that far ahead in my notes yet. I know where this is going.
We'll
get there. He records Happy Christmas, War is Over in New York in the record plant. And the record plant is obviously going to be his big haunt for the rest of the 70s. It's a very significant place. In some ways, it's the Abbey Road of his solo years for many recordings. And he has to record in the afternoon, doesn't he, because of the choir?
Yes. So the recording takes place over a couple of days, and we have Phil Spector is back. He's producing this. And we mentioned, Stewball. Phil Spector apparently remarked that the opening line, "So This Is Christmas," is exactly the same as a 1961 single called "I Love How You Love Me" by the Paris Sisters, which is a Spector production. So he's ripping things off all over the place. John also tells the guitarists, listen to Try Some, Buy Some.
Yes.
Which is the Ronnie Spector single that George wrote for, and he said, some nice mandolins on that. So could we have some of that? So he's sort of picking and choosing. But yes, they have to record because they get a 30-strong children's choir in the Harlem Community Choir come in the afternoon of the 31st of October to do the backing vocals. And it's that session, if you see the original single, there's a picture sleeve.
Yes.
And Ian McMillan, the photographer, is there, and he's taking photographs on that day.
But you talked about Ray Connolly, and Ray Connolly has an interesting role in all of this, because what we're trying to get into is the fact that John and Paul are having a bit of an interaction as we head into Christmas 1971.
It's very tactfully put.
And so Ray Connolly is involved in somewhat being an intermediary, although some of these interactions are in public and some of them are in private.
Yes. So, I mean, a few weeks into December, John and Paul start having a very public spat in the pages of Melody Maker, where Paul gives an interview and then John writes an open letter that Melody Maker publish in full. But Ray Connolly talks about being in the St. Regis Hotel, and then he says, I left New York carrying a private letter from John to deliver to Paul, an attempt by John to bypass the managers and lawyers who were engaged in the bitter feud between the two former friends. As it transpired, the legal wrangles would drag on for years, so my efforts as a go-between clearly did not work. So this must have been sort of late October, more likely early November. Ray Connolly has delivered, I suppose, a sort of a, a peace overture from John to Paul.
Yeah, and this is a private letter that we don't really know what he says in that. And Paul is still very much at this time giving interviews of saying, "Oh, I just want to, you know, sign a piece of paper and let it all be over." But he's also having to bat away, Paul, the notion of, you know, imagine it's come out in around September time, and how do you sleep is on that.
Yes.
And, you know, that's part of this kind of slinging match that's going on. And, you know, hey, Paul says, I like straights. I'm fine with that, whatever John says, blah, blah, blah. But
So Paul is this idea of Paul as the PR man. So he's sort of gathered himself. We're coming up, the first Wings album, I forget what it's called, is going to come out on the 7th of December.
Yes.
So he's doing a little bit of pre-publicity, but as you say, there's constantly this, the journalists just want to ask, well, what do you think about John? What do you think he's meant by this? What about that song? What about this song? So Paul gives a very long interview to Chris Charlesworth of Melody Maker that appears in the November 20th issue. And he basically, you know, addresses a lot of the issues and hits back at John about how do you sleep, etc. This then annoys John so much that he pens this open letter, and suddenly all of this is being played out in public. So Paul starts off by, again, as you say, just saying, well, I just want the four of us to get in a room, sign a bit of paper. Everybody thinks I'm the aggressor, but all I just want out. And this attempt by Paul to spin the story, infuriates John.
Advent, eine ganz besondere Zeit.
Plätzchen backen, Geschenke besorgen, Baum schmücken.
Und jeden Tag die Chance auf einen tollen Gewinn. Denn mit den Losen und dem Los-Adventskalender von Lotto Bayern hast du im ganzen Advent täglich Vorfreude, Nervenkitzel und echte Glücksmomente.
Welches Motiv, welche Lose? Du hast die Wahl. Nur in deiner Lotto-Annahmestelle.
Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Infos unter bzga.de.
Yeah, he talks in the interview about, how do you sleep, whatever, it's silly, you know, he knows it's not true. And, you know, he, you know, talks about, you know, his vision for what he wants. He refers to John's, attending the Toronto concert in 1969, and he calls John and Yoko not cool, you know, and...
It's the worst insult.
Not cool.
If Paul is telling you you're not cool, yeah. So he's still banging this drum of, you know, this is just before the debut Wings album, which is called Wildlife, Stephen.
And, oh, yes, of course.
And, Wings are coming down the pipe, and he's obviously in promo mode to get a bit of Wings done. He even says, I don't want Wings to become a media group with our signatures on knickers being sold for promotion, which is interesting, considering the 2020 hype for Paul McCartney that's going on. Sets John off, and he writes one of these famous kind of vitriolic letters to the Melody Maker. Dear Paul, Linda, et all the wee McCartney. So what's he getting at in that letter?
Well, this is a fascinating letter. And the other thing that's fascinating is the way that Melody Maker sort of deal with this. So they put it on the front page, and the headline is Lennon Raps Paul.
Right.
And you think, so John is referred to by his surname, Paul is sort of just Paul. So I think even that indicates, I think, that they're treating Lennon is more treated more seriously.
It might have just been to do with the font size of the headline.
Could
I
be.
Don't know.
Could
John Raps Paul sounds a bit biblical, but anyway.
It does. But so he just lets rip, and this is a classic sort of Lennon rant. But actually, if you go through the text of this letter, there are some very interesting things that emerge from the letter. So
Detective Stephen, tell us what you've discovered by studying this letter.
Well, the first thing he sort of says is, the lawyers will have to implement whatever we agree on, right? And then he says, make up your mind. E.g., 2 weeks ago, I asked you on the phone, please let's meet without advisors and decide what we want. So he's explicitly referring here to there being a phone call.
Yes.
So the temptation would be to say, well, that follows Ray Coleman delivering the private letter.
Yeah.
So there must have been some communication there. But John goes, you know, goes on, and again, he's laying out, he's saying, you said under no condition would you sell to us if we didn't do what you wanted to do. And you imagine this must be excruciatingly embarrassing for Paul to have conversations. You know, one other little lie in your It's Only Pauly melody maker, Let It Be, was not the first bit of hype on a Beatles album, which again is a sort of criticism that McCartney had raised about the hype on what was clearly the last album.
Yeah.
But then John says, but we were intending to parody Tony Barrow.
Yes.
John says
to him that it was my idea to parody the Please Please Me album cover on the Let It Be cover, which is the original Get Back cover. So it's John's idea.
Exactly. But then he says, and your writing inside of the Wings album isn't exactly the realist, is it? So it's clear that in this letter, which is published on the 4th of December, John has at least seen the album, if not heard the album.
Yeah, he must have, like, he's in New York. Somebody must have gotten him a copy of it, because he's referring to the hype on the back of the Wildlife album. So yeah, even before it hits the shops, he's lucky enough to get a copy of Wildlife in his hands as a pre-release treat.
So I think that's very interesting. I'd read this letter, I'd seen this letter a few times, but I'd never sort of thought to go through it line by line. And it's very odd that John has seen or heard this, because what that also means is he has at least seen the song title, Dear Friend.
Dear Friend, yeah.
If not actually managed to sit through the entire song.
This letter has the famous line, which I quite like, which, you know, Paul had said in the original one, I prefer Imagine, it's a bit softer than Plastic Ono Band. And John says, you think Imagine ain't political? It's Working Class Hero with sugar on it for conservatives like yourself. It's really quite funny. Your politics are very similar to Mary Whitehouse. Join the Rock Liberation Front before it gets you. It's funny that everyone thought rock was still that powerful at that time.
Yes.
It's a different era.
Nobody had ever heard of Simon Cowell in those days. So this is a really kind of vitriolic rant by John. And I think it's very calculated that he is putting into the public domain, what presumably Paul felt were private conversations.
And there's a reference in the letter that you think is to do with a previous Apple artist.
Yes, because after all of that, he signs off by saying, no hard feelings to you either. I know basically we want the same. And as I said on the phone and in this letter, whenever you want to meet, all you have to do is call.
That sounds familiar.
And I think it's that final phrase, all you have to do is call.
Yes.
Is the big hook line from You've Got a Friend.
Which had been a hit just a few months earlier.
Yeah, in May 1971. So it's like literally the last line is from the song You've Got a Friend. So I think perhaps I'm reading too much into it, but I think it's a phrase that anybody, particularly in 1971, would have instantly known what that meant. So is it a coded way of saying, you know, you've got a friend, we're still friends.
Yeah, and they are still friends, because what happens next is that they do meet in person in December 1971, which seems to be at a point after this letter. And we talk about this a little bit in our Wildlife episode. I know you've blocked that episode from your mind, but we did do an episode on Wildlife. And
I don't think I ever heard that.
And it was probably just me talking to myself. And John and Paul do meet up then later on in December 1971. And start to bury the hatchet, and then they do meet again in January 72. And we actually see all of this peter out, this kind of John and Paul public sniping kind of goes away.
I think they've kind of agreed that it's a particularly unedifying way to conduct business or to play out their relationship in public or in the pages of the music press.
That's John and Paul at Christmas 1971. There's a lot going on there, something we could easily come back to again in the future, particularly as it feeds into John sometime in New York City album as well. Paul, of course, though, is the most important thing is that Wildlife is out for on December 7th, 1971. So that's in everybody's stocking at Christmas, not particularly.
I don't recall getting it in 1971. But, and in that episode, it's all coming back to me now. We did, it's like bubbling up. We did talk about, you know, the launch party and...
Yes, all that stuff. That all the dancers and
Paul's suit that wasn't finished in time and all of that. So crazy people, guy. People, if they really want to, rather than listen to the album, it's much better to listen to our episode on the album.
Ringo in Christmas 1971, 200 Motels premieres, and we talk about that in our Ringo Starr movie star episode. And George, you know, we said he was the winner of Christmas 1970. Is he the winner of Christmas 1971? Because he has put an awful lot of effort into getting the concert for Bangladesh happening in 1971 and to get the album out for Christmas 1971, yes. Which it doesn't come out for Christmas in the UK. It comes out in January 72, but it does get out just in time for Christmas in the US. And that's a pretty big achievement.
That's a pretty big achievement. It comes out on the 20th of December in the States and in January in 1972 in the UK. There seems to be a bit of a tortured history to this, and we maybe we'll do an episode on Bangladesh, the concert, and all the sort of legal machinations that went on behind the scene to get this out. But essentially, you know, there were early mixes that had to be approved by the various artists. You know, George was sending, you think of the lineup on the stage at that time. You know, the only one was Leon Russell. I think he chose to remix his version of Jumpin' Jack Flash. Some touching up of vocals on Why My Guitar Gently Weeps, a bit of an edit on Wah Wah. Mm. But generally speaking, the work on the album has been done fairly early on. There's comments about Spector wanting to push up the crowd noise to sort of get the excitement, etc. But then the actual release is delayed because there's an argument between Capitol and Columbia being Dylan's record label. Yeah. And I think it was decided that Columbia would have the cassette version of the album and then, you know, Capitol would get the rest. But it's just going on and on and on and on, and it's not getting to the market, and therefore the money isn't coming in and the money isn't going to get to the beneficiaries. And if you go on to YouTube, you can see George's appearance on the Dick Cavett show.
Yeah, this is where the Dick Cavett appearance is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he's trying to force the issue.
He is. It's the last week in November. He's desperate to get this out for Christmas, and he goes on to this show and basically says Capitol are profiteering off the backs of famine victims, and I'm going to take this elsewhere. I'm going to take the whole thing to Columbia. And Capitol back down. They agree to release it on Harrison's terms, and it finally hits the shops just before Christmas.
Mm. And it's held off the number one spot by Don McLean's American Pie in the US.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Now, what we say, this is another box set triple album with George's name attached to it. So the first two post solo albums. And I'd read before, you know, it went out at an extraordinarily high price. Mm. And it says in the UK, it was £5.50 in old money and $12.98 in the States. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem particularly high. In today's money,
I've done the number crunching.
You could buy that in the UK in January for the equivalent of £71.15.
That's what the triple vinyl All Things Must Pass, I think, roughly costs if you would go to a record store today to buy it.
Yeah. So you think, but it got to number two.
Yeah.
You know, something that was costing the equivalent of seventy pounds. In the UK, it got to number one. Certified gold on the 4th of January in the US for 500,000 sales. And in March 73, won the Grammy Award for Album of the Year. And there's a photograph you can find on the internet of Ringo at the ceremony in Nashville, literally with a tray of Grammys, because every artist who was there had to get a Grammy.
I'd say there was another tray in the other hand of something else. Of Brandy Alexander's.
Yes.
So that's Christmas 1971. Things do start to calm down a little bit. Christmas 1972, George actually isn't nearly as visible. In fact, I think for George, for Christmas 1972, he's probably just sitting in Friar Park. We haven't had a...
having a rest.
He's having a well-deserved rest.
He's put out two triple albums, done some production work at Apple. You know,
he's allowed to have some time off.
Yeah.
Ringo himself, he we talked about his movies in our episode, but Born to Boogie gets premiered in time for Christmas 1972. That premiere party we talked about is on December 14th. Son of Dracula is in post-production, and that'll take about a decade. In some ways, has it ever really been produced? And my favorite part of Ringo at Christmas 1972 is, who visits him at home on Christmas Day?
Keith Moon.
That's exactly who you want to see. There are heart sink moments in your life when you're sitting down and the doorbell rings and you're like, oh Jesus. But
Somebody with a present.
Keith Moon knocking on Ringo's door on Christmas Day. For the Beatles themselves, again, the entity that is the Beatles is still, you know, in legal quagmire, but certainly a lot more civil than they were the previous year. Help, the movie, is on Boxing Day on the BBC. And yes, Old Grey Whistle Test shows cavern footage.
Yes, I don't think I would have been allowed to stay up late enough to see the Old Grey Whistle Test, but this might be the first time I saw, or at least remember seeing, the Beatles on TV.
You must have just been in the crib, Stephen.
I was in the crib. My parents pushed the crib in front of the TV and went out for the night. My earliest memory of the Beatles is that scene at the end of Help of them running down the beach.
Okay. There weren't many avenues for it to be on TV.
No.
The distant past. So,
in 1972.
1972. That's only 3 or 4 years ago. That's absolutely normal. What I've noticed online is, you know, the Beatles at Christmas on the BBC in the 70s it means a lot to a lot of people. There are a core group of people who were too young for the Beatles in the 60s for whom those Christmas exhibitions on BBC Two really meant a lot and really connected them with the group. So they can't be overstated how important they were. So then there's John for Christmas 1972, and that's when he finally manages to get Happy Christmas War Is Over out in the UK. And that's a publishing thing. I mean, it seems like it was too late to get the tapes over and back and get it pressed and published because it's only finished at the end of October. But publishing is the reason given, and there is a publishing problem, isn't there?
There is. I mean, this relates back to Lou Grade and ITV Music having taken over Northern Songs. So around this time, you'll notice that Paul starts writing with Linda, John starts writing with Yoko, which means essentially there's a 50-50 split on the royalties before it ever gets anywhere near ATV. Yeah. Lou Grade doesn't take kindly to this, and he threatens all sorts of legal things. Ultimately leads to the James Paul McCartney special for ATV. So it's not all bad.
Well, it leads to John appearing on the tribute to Lou Grade as well. So
exactly. So we kind of got these two things to come out of it. But yeah, I think this is part of the reason there's still this wrangling going on about publishing. So here we are, 3-4 years later, and this is still going on. But the song gets to number four, and in December 1980, it got to number two,
and it keeps reappearing in the charts every year. Yeah. I remember the CD single came out of it in 1988, and it was a supplement CD single to go with the Imagine soundtrack, and so I felt compelled. That's how I first owned Happy Christmas War Is Over. But it's also the halcyon early 70s days of UK Christmas chart smash hits, which, John is leading the charge. And it is noticeable that, the Christmas charts and Christmas singles, I think, have a different type of resonance in the UK than they do in the US. The US don't really care about the Christmas number one. It's a different type of race. I mean, there is Christmas music and Christmas classics, but it's a different type of thing, I would say.
It is. It's always been a particular sort of badge of honour to have a number one at Christmas in the UK. Mm. I'm not quite sure that is it just a sort of kind of show busy entertainment thing, or is that's always been the case? It is strange. It seems to be a uniquely British phenomenon. Mm.
And Paul then for Christmas 1972 is he's putting out High High High,
another Christmas song,
getting high 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 Christmas, and this is the guy just can't catch a break. He's banned by the BBC,
Yeah, it's odd. When you think about it, it's a very odd song to put out at Christmas, you don't think?
Well, given
that in the UK, Christmas number one is a thing.
Yes. No, I think that whole... Paul's whole 1972 is just kind of odd anyway, you know, but that space, and we talked about in the episodes in season one, that kind of odd space between Wings Wildlife and Red Rose Speedway, and he's putting out standalone singles, and he's not really being cool, and all the court stuff is happening, and his press is bad, and yeah, it's just...
We touched on this before. This is the point at which he is really struggling. Of the four, he is the one that is confounding the sort of commercial expectations, and he really is struggling.
Yeah. So he has high out, and it's banned because the BBC think he says body gun, but of course he says polygon, of course, which
lay you on the bed, get you ready for my polygon. That makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah, for you and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
and also it's the high is a kind of drug reference. So he's going for drug references, sexual references. And the result is that the B side or the double A side, Sea Moon, is the one that gets all the airplay.
And that's one where he does sound high.
Yeah. Do you think that missed intro is deliberate? He rehearsed the missed intro.
Well, we know he has form for rehearsing mistakes, but it's still the vibe of Sea Moon it's got a smoky vibe.
Can I give you my fun fact about this single?
Go on.
It gets a number 5 in the UK, number 10 in the US in January 1973, but it gets a number 1 in Spain, which is where he wrote the song.
That's very interesting. I did not know that.
There you go.
That's Generalissimo Franco for you.
No. Always a great patron of the arts, allegedly.
And there's other kind of movies and things knocking around. ABC TV in the States shows John's one-to-one gig from 1972, which is the Live in New York City concert film that we know from later years. And the Imagine film is also shown on TV. So, you know, they're still out there.
Still box office.
Oh, big time. And then Christmas 1973, the BBC again show A Hard Day's Night on Boxing Day.
Did they have nothing else to show?
They're just showing the same two films over and over. Well,
what could they have shown? Magical Mystery Tour on, you know.
It wouldn't have hurt, you know. So which order to go in, I guess. I mean, Ringo is... again, at a movie premiere. So the Blind Man premiere is on December the 27th. But Ringo is starting to become the Ringo that we know and love.
He's king of the world.
He is king of the world because Photograph has headed up the charts, and the Ringo LP is definitely going into stockings for Christmas.
Yep. So he is absolutely top of his game commercially here and leaving everybody else in the shade.
Apparently he eats turkey for Christmas. Did you know that, Stephen?
I thought it was a sausage. I thought he had a sausage at Christmas despite being a vegetarian.
He's a vegetarian. He's asked in Christmas 73, you know, are you a vegetarian? He says, yeah, I am, but I still like turkey at Christmas. And so that's what he does.
You can't be too draconian about these things.
So Ringo is starting to have his dizzying heights as a solo artist, and you can go off and listen to our episode about the Ringo album from season 2. George, apparently for Christmas 1973, he's sitting by a log fire putting together some music. Is that right?
That's right. I was listening, just as you do, to a promotional interview that he gave in 1975 for the Extra Texture album.
Right.
And, you know, you've got to pull all these threads together. And they talk about the song Can't Stop Thinking About You. And he said, yeah, I remember. I think I wrote that in 1973. I was sitting by a log fire at Christmas. So... there you go.
And that turns up on Extra Texture, yeah.
Extra Texture. And I think the song His Name Is Legs, ladies and gentlemen, is also written around that time. And again, that's an Extra Texture song.
And that's Legs Larry Smith from the Bonzo.
Legs Larry Smith. He is a great character. Anybody doesn't know, he's the drummer with the Bonzo Dog Doo Dah Band. Very close friend of George's and had involvement in various things. He if you've ever seen the film Bullshot,
yes,
be careful how I say that, handmade film, which is kind of send up of Bulldog Drummond English, sort of 39 steps. He's a tap dancer, Tap Dance on Elton John song, I Think I'm Gonna Kill Myself.
Yeah, that's a funny song.
Yeah, from but he's, you know, needs Honky Chateau, needs tap dancing.
Yep.
And he designed the cover for Gone Troppo in 1982.
And yes, and I know what you're going to, I know exactly what you're going to say next.
And by extension, I suppose he also therefore should get a credit for Paul's Egypt Station album, which is a direct ripoff of Gone Troppo.
I don't see the connection myself, but if you say
apart
so.
Apart from the exactly similar layout and colours.
Yeah, listen, you know, Paul's an original. So that's George. Paul... in December 1973 for Christmas, he gives a great present to the world, which is Band on the Run, which goes on to make a bit of a difference in his solo career.
It does. We've kind of talked about this in the 74 episode. Yeah. It's a bit of a slow build, slow burn.
And it's the second album of 73. It just slips out just in time for Christmas. It doesn't have a massive fanfare, although it's the one that makes the biggest impact.
And this is the thing. This is the thing that's, you know, no doubt we'll have a 5-part episode on Band on the Run at some point. But I'm joking. Oh. It has a really slow burn. Doesn't set the world on fire to begin with.
And then Paul and Linda make an experimental art film. No, they don't. They appear on the BBC TV Disney Time Christmas special.
In lovely jumpers,
in full-on Bruce McMouse mode. I guess you could argue he's got young kids at home. This is the meat and potatoes of what he wants to be doing.
It's funny because that it seems to me that the Disney thing is you know, we have Mary Had a Little Lamb standalone single. He's kind of all over the place. You've got the James McCartney special, then you've got this, and then in 1974 he becomes rock star Paul. And to a certain degree, for a while he puts away the Christmas jumpers and the family entertainment approach, and he has a huge international success with Wings the Rock Band.
Yeah, no, and that whole Wings Around the World routine.
Yeah, so this is really your last chance to see Paul in a jumper, is what we're saying.
That's worth noting down. But do you know what I like to do on Christmas Day, Stephen, is I like to go see a nice concert.
Yes.
In a cathedral, maybe, you know.
Yeah, some lovely Christmas
uplifting music. Do you know if I was on holidays, maybe in New York, on Christmas Day, 1973, could I have enjoyed such a concert?
You could. I mean, if you happen to be at the Cathedral of John the Divine, I think there was something on that day. If I check my notes, it was on Christmas Day. Yoko was playing a concert in the cathedral.
That's kind of exciting. Do we know what she was playing, what her set list was?
I really don't. I'm going to have to look that up. And
if that's on Setlist FM, I will be very surprised.
If I can find the setlist for this, I will put together a Spotify playlist and we'll put it up with the... you'd like to think it must be a little bit acoustic-y. Maybe she does Listen, the Snow is Falling. Some Christmas themed.
But what's very interesting is, I mean, Lennon at this point, you know, Mind Games has just come out in November. It is funny how all these albums come out for Christmas time. And Yoko's doing this concert, but she has David Spinoza is playing with her. Now, he's an interesting guy. Tell us about him.
He is. David Spinoza was Yoko's band leader around this time. And he had... worked on Mind Games, worked with, we'll go on to work with Yoko on Feeling the Space. He was, as I say, part of her live set. But the first Beatles connection that I'm aware of is he worked with Paul during the Ram sessions in late 71.
Mm. Yeah, so as we said, Ram, you know, starts to come together in New York in October 71 and November 71. And David Spinoza is part of the crack session crew that gets the call up for Ram as Paul is trying to put feelers out to see whether, 1970 rather, when they're recording, as he puts the feelers out to, you know, as he, you know, starts to put Wings together in his mind. So Denny Seawell is pulled from that pack for Wings, doesn't get the call.
Spinoza works for him, does some recording, but then Paul lets him go.
Yeah.
And he's replaced by Hugh McCracken, who's again another top session player who will turn up much, much later in the day on Double Fantasy.
Yeah, and what's kind of sweet is that David Spinoza, once he does start working with Yoko and John's Orbit, is he doesn't mention Paul at all, or he's afraid to mention Paul.
That's it. There's an interview with him where he talks about he discovered that Lennon was not aware that he'd worked with McCartney. This is during the Mind Game session, and he was afraid he was going to be fired. But when Lennon did learn of it, his only comment was that, you know, Paul knows how to pick good people.
I think that's a very short but telling statement, you know?
Yeah.
Because it reinforces John's decision if Paul has made the same decision. This guy is thinking that there's going to be conflict, and John's response is, oh, I must have done something right. Paul picks good people. That's great. Let's keep on going.
Yes, that's it. And, there's an interview from Guitar World in 2012 with Spinoza, and they sort of ask him about Paul McCartney, and he goes, oh, yeah, he's the cute Beatle. And I said, he's all kidding aside, he's as talented as he is cute. Very creative man. But I actually recall an interview with Spinoza in which he was quite dismissive of McCartney.
All right.
He was sort of saying, you know, he didn't even know the names of the chords, and he would play something and say, oh, play that, you know, the pretty chord, the nice sounding one. And, you know, it would be a very different experience, I think, for McCartney to end up in New York amongst these absolutely top session players.
Yeah.
Who are extreme, you know, it's like the Wrecking Crew style of approach, where you or the Motown guys, that they're there, they're professionals there to do a job. But what seems to have happened is that McCartney said, come and play on this album, you working with me, you don't play any other gigs. Mm. But Spinoza realized that they were free in the afternoon, and he started moonlighting, and Paul gave him the elbow.
Oh, gosh. He also goes on to work with Ringo. So he's worked with three of the four Beatles. He's on the Ringo the Fourth album in 1977. And the other thing that's happening about Christmas is that John is involved in the song Too Many Cooks with Mick Jagger.
Yes.
That's an odd thing. How did all that happen?
That's a bit of
It's a bit of a little dark black hole, isn't it?
It is, and it's not a song that comes out at all, you know, and it's a fantastic performance.
Yeah.
I've read interviews with the engineers saying, you know, they knew this was just for fun.
Mm.
They knew this wasn't going to come out. This isn't going to end up on a Stones record. It's not going to end up on a Lennon record. It was just something they were doing for fun, and Lennon produces it. And it finally turns up on The Best of Mick Jagger. I'm sure everybody has that in there.
Is it the only song on The Best of Mick Jagger? That's a low blow. I do apologize.
That's a low blow.
It's
probably the best song on but it's very good. But it shows you sort of heading into the quote unquote lost weekend session. John is coming out of a sort of Mind Games. He's been quite creative. Mm. Then we have this kind of tip into 1974.
Yeah. And that brings us to the end of Christmas 1973. And it also brings us to the end of part one of The Beatles at Christmas. Now, you know, as if we have planned this, we advise you, now that we've reached the end of 1973, to go back and listen to our two episodes about 1974, which will fill in all the four seasons between Christmas 73 and Christmas 74 before we jump back into The Beatles in Christmas in the 70s in part two, when we're going to cover from 1974 to 1979.
Yeah.
But that's all we have for this time. What do you think? Was anybody out there watching the Beatles Christmas performances being shown on BBC during the 1970s? Or if you have any other ideas, let us know. We are always available in the usual places. We're on Twitter at Beatles Pod. We have the Nothing Is Real private Facebook group, which Stephen will let you into. And, you know, we appreciate all the downloads and all the nice comments. Wherever you get your podcasts, we really want to thank you all for all of those. But for now, for part one of The Beatles at Christmas, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.